Heard deep in the room, a conversation that could not happen unless one of the talkers was outside the tanks. The hairs on the back of his neck stood on end. One of the prisoners must have gotten out. That wasn't possible, but what other explanation could there be? He rushed back to the computer, turned on the holding area emergency lock, and activated the escaped prisoner protocol. Ricky and Rosario ducked behind the woman's cage, but instead of the door swinging open in a blaze of light, they heard a low hiss. "Gas!" Rosario said. They raced across the room, no longer worried about concealing their presence. Ricky reached the door first and tried to yank it open, but it didn't budge. He whirled around and shined his light through the room, focusing on the walls. "There has to be another way out." Rosario made her own scan and shook her head.
"There's not!"
"Damn it, damn it, damn it!" He began feeling woozy and knew they didn't have much time. Perhaps they couldn't do anything to save themselves for now, but they could protect their friends. He threw his phone on the floor and stomped on it, breaking it apart. He dropped to his knees and sifted through the debris until he found the SIM card. Before he snapped it in half, he looked at Rosario. She was standing there, pointing her light at him.
"What are you waiting for?"
he asked.
"Would you rather do that in the dark?"
"Oh, right," he said. As soon as he broke his SIM card, Rosario popped out hers and destroyed it, too. Ricky, closer to the floor, began coughing uncontrollably. A few seconds later, Rosario convulsed in her own fit. She cocked her arm and let her phone fly. Ricky watched its light shine until the phone crashed against the wall. He heard its shattered body fall to the floor only a few seconds before Rosario did the same. Vander waited 2 minutes after the gas cycle had completed before turning on the exhaust system. Once the green light came on, he entered the room, holding the M4 rifle he thought he'd never need down here. Having heard the pounding on the door, he knew he'd find the attempted escapee not far inside. What he hadn't expected was to discover two bodies, neither of which was one of the prisoners. He checked to make sure both were knocked out before he ran back to his desk and called Mr. Slater. Slater marched out of the elevator exactly 11 minutes later. Vander was waiting for him once more near the door, this time clearly nervous.
"Where?"
Slater said.
"In the holding room, sir. I put them in two of the empty tanks."
Slater veered toward the holding room and flung the doors aside.
"Lights, goddammit!"
"Right, yes, sir. Sorry, sir."
The flood lamps lit up, and a few seconds later, Van joined Slater inside.
"Which ones?"
"I'll show you."
Vander led him to a transparent box a couple of spots from the door. The cot had been removed, so the body inside lay directly on the platform. The man was what some might call Caucasian, but his tan skin and Mediterranean features spoke of inferior blood. 6 foot, maybe 6'2", and 3 or 4 days past due for a shave. His hair was neatly trimmed, however. He wore dark blue jeans, a leather jacket over a black t-shirt, and black boots.
"The woman's two down."
A Mex, or whatever she wanted to call herself, from somewhere south like that. Tiny, 5'1" if she was lucky, dark hair and dark clothes.
"Did they have anything on them?"
Slater asked, his eyes still on the intruder.
"He had some loose cash, $240, and these."
Van moved around the side of the tank and picked a few things off the floor. In one hand, he held several small black squares Slater couldn't immediately identify. In the other was something he knew well, a Beretta pistol and attached suppressor. Slater grabbed the gun, brand new, with a full magazine. He could tell the suppressor was high quality. Who the hell are these guys? When Vander had called, Slater had assumed the intruders were FBI or ATF, but a Fed wouldn't snoop around with equipment like this. CIA? Maybe, but he doubted it. Could be private investigators. Maybe someone actually cared about one of the unwanted and had hired these two to find him or her. But even that seemed far-fetched. Not only were the collection teams trained to take only those who wouldn't be missed, but Slater and Yates had also taken great pains in setting up the organization so that it would be nearly impossible to connect the different segments. Someone had found them, though. This was it? No IDs? Nothing else? Vander hesitated.
What? They both had phones, but...
Phones? God damn it, give them to me! Vander looked like he was going to say something else, but instead he jogged back into the lobby and returned a few moments later with two plastic bags.
What are those?
Vander held out one of the bags.
They're phones, sir.
Slater grabbed it and looked inside. The broken remains were gathered at the bottom.
What the fuck happened?
I'm not sure, sir. I found one on the floor near the guy and the other lying next to the wall.
The intruders must have destroyed their phones on purpose.
Did you dig out the SIM cards at least?
They're in there, too. Both snapped in half.
Are you shitting me?
I'm not, sir.
Slater swore under his breath and looked at the other bag. More plastic items, but these appeared intact.
What's in there?
Vander handed him the second bag.
I found these on them. I'm not sure what they are.
Slater pulled out one of the items. It was a small plastic square that had a sticky surface on one side, covered by a thin protective sheet. He knew exactly what it was. A tracking bug.
At least tell me you know how they got in, he said.
I don't know for sure, sir, but I would guess it happened when we were loading the product onto your truck.
As mad as Slater felt, he was clear-headed enough to realize Van was probably right. He also realized the other potential ramification. If the captives had been able to get into his truck while he was in the barn, they may have bugged it. He kept the bag of bugs, but handed the other one back to Van.
Get rid of this crap.
Yes, sir.
Vander hesitated.
What do you want me to do with them?
Slater thought for a moment. Whoever these two assholes were, they were problems that would only get bigger if they were let go. The only sound option was to get rid of them. He walked over and pulled the red sticker from the tank of the Mex kid whom he'd wanted to sell to the Arab. He did the same on the tank holding the 20-something mixed-blood woman, as they'd be able to get a little cash for her, too. Slater transferred the stickers to the tanks of the intruders.
Send them over with the others tonight.
Yes, sir.
Slater hurried back topside, conducted an exhaustive search of his truck, and found two bugs. He put them into the bag with the others, stomped them with his boot a couple of times, and tossed the whole lot into the pond. 23. Ananka checked her phone as she returned to her hotel room after her lunch with Scudder. Ricky had texted her about 15 minutes earlier while she was talking to Scudder. He and Rosario had found the truck at Green Hills Estates. Ananka's immediate thought was to wonder if she'd misread Scudder. Was he involved? She hurried over to her computer and brought up a satellite image of Scudder's property at the estates. Ricky had mentioned a pond, but there was no pond at Scudder's. She zoomed out until she had a view of the entire development. She spotted a body of water several properties west of Scudder's place. As she magnified the area, she remembered her conversation with Tony Mahoney when the woman had told her about swimming in a pond at the farm that used to be in the valley. It seemed likely they were one and the same. Near the pond stood a big building, a garage or barn or perhaps even a guest house. The main house sat to the south, a mansion bigger than most of the others in the development. She opened a video chat window and called Shinji.
Hey, boss,
he answered. Something I need you to check out right away. She described the house and told him its location. I need to know who owns it.
Shouldn't take more than a minute or two. Do you want me to give you the info on the people in Ricky's pictures first?
It took her a second to remember what he was talking about. The pictures would be the ones Ricky had taken while witnessing the delivery the previous evening. Rosario had asked Shinji to ID the security personnel. You've got names?
Of course I've got names. This is what I do, remember?
She rolled her eyes. All right, Mr. Hotshot, let's hear it. She heard him click a key, and his face was replaced by one of Ricky's pics, cropped close to focus on one of the guards.
This one's name is Patrick Monroe. He is 24 and has worked for Scalarian for 3 years. His personnel file is nice and clean, regular yearly raises in line with company norms, and no mentions of trouble.
The image switched to another guard.
This is Ryan Porter, 25, also been at Scalarian for 3 years. Clean record, regular raises. Though it's not in either of their company files, he and Monroe are first cousins. Their family has been in the Bradbury area since the early 1900s.
Related? That's interesting.
It is a small town.
True. The picture changed to a guard a couple of decades older than the other two.
Man number three is Leonard Yates. He is 44 and has been with Scalarian for nearly 5 years, and get this, he's their head of security.
Yates? I met a Yates at the party, but he was a lot older.
Let me guess, he was the chief of police?
Yeah, he was.
He's Leonard Yates's father.
Well, I'll be damned.
I know, right? But that's not all. Though Leonard isn't related by blood to Porter or Monroe, he is via his brother's wife, Catherine Porter, who is Porter and Monroe's aunt. You want to guess her married name?
I don't know. Scudder? Shinji laughed.
That would have been good, but no. Slater.
Slater? As in Dalton Slater?
One and the same.
They're brothers?
Technically, half-brothers. Same mom, different dads. Slater's older by 2 years. Yates' dad basically raised them both. Holy crap. I'm not done. Before Yates the Younger was hired at Scholarian, he and his brother started a security company called Riverside Trusted Security. Still up and running, ostensibly with Catherine Slater in charge. RTS provides security services, including guards, to many of the businesses in town, such as UJ Soft, Claytone, Digital Paste, Remakers 2100, and given what you just asked me to find out, you're gonna love this. All the guards at Green Hills Estates. Ananga said nothing as she processed what this all meant. Clearly, the Yates-Slater family was like a fungus infecting the entire area. Excellent work, Shinji. Thanks, boss. Now, if you give me a minute, I'll track down who owns the house. Take two if you need it. While he worked on that, Ananga called Ricky for an update. The line didn't ring even once before,
Ricky ain't here, but Ricky will get back to you when Ricky can. Only if you leave a message, though.
After the beep, she said, It's me, call back. She tried Rosario, but was also sent to voicemail. Thinking maybe they'd been able to get a bug on Slater and were following him, she opened her tracking program. The only bugs that showed up were the ones she'd put on the police cruisers.
Got it, Shinji announced from the computer.
It took her a moment to remember what she'd tasked him with. Whose house is it?
It's owned by a corporation.
A corporation?
I believe you've heard of them. Digital Paste?
Within 6 minutes, Ananka was parked in the lot next to Digital Paste's headquarters, mentally transforming herself back into Sean Raimi. When she was ready, she headed inside. Perky Chad was behind the reception counter again.
Welcome to Digital Paste. How can I...
Oh, Miss Raimi, so good to see you again. Were we expecting you?
She smiled apologetically and said,
Not exactly. I was hoping maybe Devin might have a moment to chat.
Chad's own smile faded.
I'm so sorry. Mr. Rowley isn't feeling well, so he didn't come in today.
Oh, no. I hope it's nothing too serious.
He gets migraines sometimes. I'm sure he'll be back in a day or so. Is there someone else who could help you?
She hesitated a moment before saying, Is Elijah in? Elijah Chan rose as his executive assistant ushered Ananka into his office.
Good to see you again. Please, have a seat.
Thank you. She settled into one of the chairs in front of his desk.
Can we get you something to drink? Coffee? Tea?
Water?
Of course.
Chan looked at his assistant.
Water, please, Chloe. Actually, make that too.
Ananka casually surveyed the room. It was more cluttered than what she remembered from the glimpse she'd gotten of Raleigh's office. Not messily so, but in a way that denoted someone who is elbows deep in a lot of different projects.
I hope I'm not disturbing you, she said.
Not at all.
Are you sure about that?
She said, nodding at the thick three-ring binder opened in the middle of his desk. It had little post-it flags sticking out from the tops of dozens of pages. He chuckled.
We have a new app that goes live next month. There's always a few last-minute glitches that need to be sorted first.
Don't you have people to do that?
Sure, but another set of eyes never hurts.
Plus, it's your company.
And there's that. Well, mine and Devon's, of course.
Confession time, she said. I actually came by to see him. He'd mentioned that if I had any questions, he'd be happy to answer them, but I understand he's out today.
He is. Sorry about that. Is there something I can help you with?
If you don't mind.
Of course not.
Thank you. She leaned forward. One of the things I'm concerned about is housing. I've been told that a new phase of the tract north of downtown is about to start, which is great. But I'm wondering if I'm just having smoke blown up my ass, or if it's really going to happen.
Chan laughed again, louder this time.
You don't beat around the bush, do you?
That wastes too much time.
True. I don't know the specifics of their timeline, but I can say that Barry Hurst, he's the developer, is an up-and-up guy. I have nothing but good things to say about him.
That's a relief. I'm guessing that's where a majority of our people would be living if we relocate here.
They'll love it. I know my wife and I do.
You live there?
Yep, on Circuit Circle.
He smirked.
Cheesy, I know, but it's a nice neighborhood.
I kind of thought you'd be one of the folks out at Green Hills Estates.
You'd have to ask Devin about that. That's where he lives. We're much more comfortable where we are.
Ananka asked him other questions about the area, repeating some she'd asked Scudder at lunch. When she felt enough time had passed, she said,
Thank you. I appreciate you taking a break to talk.
My pleasure. And if you still want to ask Devin anything, I'm sure he'll be back tomorrow.
I'll keep that in mind. As soon as she was back in her car, she called Shinji. It's Devon Rowley's place.
That's the slimy one Rosario told me about, isn't it?
Find out everything you can about him. 24. Morgan Harris had not gone back to bed after Sean Raimi and her friends made their unexpected visit. If what Sean and the others had told her was true, Tasha had inadvertently gotten mixed up with something big and bad happening right here in Bradbury. Morgan might have been scared for her girlfriend before, but she was terrified now. Her first thought was to go to Scholarian and lock Kyle Scudder in a room until he told her everything. But she knew if Sean and her friends were really here to help, and Harris's gut told her they were, then doing that might screw things up for them. She paced through her house, overflowing with energy that needed release. This pent-up anxiety gnawed at her, screaming that she needed to do something until she got it in her head that shadowing Sean would be a good idea. She justified the plan by telling herself she'd only be making sure Ananka hadn't fed her a pack of lies, but in truth, she was hoping to be close by when they found Tasha. She grabbed her keys and headed out the door, but made it only a few steps before she realized the flaw in her plan. Sean would know her car. Morgan thought for a moment and pulled out her phone.
"Hi, Sarah," she said when her old high school friend answered. "I've got the day off and was wondering if I might borrow your pickup to run some errands."
As she knew would happen, Sarah said yes. Her next call was to Travis Blake, one of the junior officers who was always looking for extra shifts.
"Travis, it's Morgan Harris. Would you be interested in covering graveyard for me tonight?"
Morgan parked down the street from the Collins Inn and picked out Sean Raimi's Mustang in the parking lot through her binoculars. She settled in, ready for a long wait, but only 8 minutes passed before Sean exited the inn and walked to her car. As the Mustang drove away, Morgan followed at a discreet distance. Turned out to be a short drive, as Sean parked a few blocks away near TJ's Grill. She entered the restaurant at 12:30. Morgan found a parking place half a block away, and toyed with the idea of walking by the cafe to see if Sean was meeting anyone. That thought vanished the moment she noticed two of Sean's associates, the Asian woman and the Irish guy, strolling down the street, looking in shops. Though they avoided walking by TJ's, their presence in the area couldn't be a coincidence. When it seemed they might be heading her way, Harris pulled back onto the road and made a quick U-turn to avoid being seen. Her new vantage point was farther down the road, but she still had a decent view of the cafe's entrance. Sean reemerged almost exactly an hour after she'd entered. As she headed toward her car, her two friends, who'd continued roaming the neighborhood the whole time Sean was inside, quickly made their way to another vehicle. Morgan was worried the other two would follow Sean and spot Morgan if she tried to do the same. So she let the Mustang pull onto the road and waited to see what the others did. When they headed in a different direction, she pulled out and took off after the Mustang. As she passed the cafe, she nearly hit the brakes in surprise when the door opened and Kyle Scudder walked out. Was he the one Sean had met? Did that mean Sean was actually working for Scudder and the people Tasha had tangled with? Morgan followed Sean back to the Collins Inn. Again, the woman stayed inside the hotel for only a short time before returning to her vehicle. Her destination this time was Digital Paste, one of the star tech firms that were transforming Bradbury. What did Digital Paste have to do with Tasha? Morgan couldn't remember her girlfriend ever mentioning the company. She chanced driving by the entrance soon after Sean had gone inside and caught a glimpse of her standing in the lobby, seemingly waiting for someone. 20 minutes later, Sean returned to the Mustang and Morgan followed. 25. Lunch was lighter than breakfast, enough to replenish the energy expelled during the morning's testing session and fortify everyone for the initial trial that afternoon. Much to the chagrin of several of the participants, no alcohol was served. As soon as the meal was completed and the dishes removed, Miss Riefenstahl entered the room carrying an envelope.
"Congratulations to you all for your work this morning," she said. "Your scores have been tabulated and your individual levels determined. These have been used to appropriately tailor the groupings for today's trials and determine the equipment best suited for each of you."
As she opened one of the envelopes, Mr. Wells said,
"Aren't you going to tell us our levels?"
Miss Riefenstahl paused.
"The levels are unimportant and only have bearing on our preparation. We found that sharing this information can, frankly, be disruptive. That said, if you wish to know yours, you may approach me after the final trial at the end of the gathering."
Satisfied looks graced the faces of a few participants.
These were the ones who would ask later. Each would be told the same thing, that they had ranked at or near the top of the group. Sugary words meant to ensure their satisfaction with their visit, and none of them true. Miss Riefenstahl removed a card from the envelope. It was all for show, of course. She knew the groupings already.
Mr. Wells, Mr. Hawks, and Mr. Ford, you will be the first grouping. And Mr. Houston, Mr. Wise, and Mr. Reed, you will go next.
She lowered the card.
Now, if you would all follow me.
She led them to the armory, where two of the young men who did double duty as meal servers outfitted each participant with the weapons chosen for them. Mr. Wells, Mr. Hawks, and Mr. Ford received identical Smith & Wesson 9mm pistols, Mossberg Maverick double-barrel shotguns, and Remington Sendero hunting rifles. Mr. Houston, Mr. Wise, and Mr. Reed were given the same types of pistols and shotguns, but instead of rifles, were provided Raven R-15 crossbows. After the assistants ensured each participant could properly operate his weapons, they gave the men their specialized vests. Traditionally, hunters donned bright reflective outerwear to cut down on the possibility of being shot. The trial vests performed the same tasks, though they were not reflective or made from brightly colored material. Instead, sewn into the padding were transponders that would activate a beeping signal on a weapon any time it pointed at a vest. Miss Riefenstahl escorted them to a pair of off-road transports that looked like tricked-out golf carts. The drive from the lodge took 10 minutes, followed by a short hike led by Miss Riefenstahl down a well-worn path to a clearing in the woods. The meadow was V-shaped, with the path letting out at the point where the two sides met. Mr. Lean stood 75 feet away, on a steel-reinforced platform approximately 2 feet high, with ramps leading down on the three sides not facing the bottom of the V.
Mr. Houston, Mr. Wise, and Mr. Reed, if you will please take a seat in the waiting area.
Miss Riefenstahl gestured to the eastern edge of the clearing, where two rows of bleachers had been set up. As they walked off, she turned to Mr. Wells, Mr. Hawks, and Mr. Ford.
Gentlemen, this way, please.
She led them to an area in front of the platform and had them stand in a line facing it.
Welcome, gentlemen, to the first trial, Mr. Lean said. Each group will have 2 hours to complete the task. Once both rounds are completed, you will return to the lodge for a quick meal, and then your next few hours should be spent resting for the midnight event. The sooner you finish this afternoon's trial, the more rest you will have for tonight's. Is everyone ready?
Hell yes, Mr. Wells said.
Let's do it, Mr. Ford threw in.
Mr. Hawks, however, was trying to keep from shaking and said nothing. Mr. Lean looked past the group and nodded. A moment later, a middle-aged man the participants hadn't seen before and one of the younger assistants escorted the game, a disheveled but nervous Caucasian man, onto the platform.
Gentlemen, your trophy, Mr. Lean said. I want to reiterate that the object is to work together to bring it down. If you try to go solo, it will be noted by our observers, and you will be disqualified from this event. Are there any questions?
Yeah, I got one,
Mr. Wells said, leering at the target with a hunter's lust.
What's the fastest anyone's completed this trial?
27 minutes.
Mr. Wells' smile grew, as if he had every intention of breaking the record.
Anyone else?
Mr. Lean asked. The men shook their heads.
Very well, then. For this trial, the prey will be given 2 minutes after they reach the woods before the hunt begins. If you leave before I have released you, you will be disqualified.
Does the record timer start when it is released, or when we go?
Mr. Wells asked.
When you go.
Okay, good. Just wanted to make sure.
Mr. Lane looked at each hunter to make sure there was nothing else, then said,
Prepare the trophy.
While the young assistant held on to the trophy's arms, the older man pulled out a knife and sliced through the bindings holding the prey's wrists behind his back. The two turned the captive to face away from the hunters and toward the ramp at the back of the platform. The older man whispered something to the prisoner that ratcheted up the terror in the prey's eyes.
Group one, Mr. Lean said. The first of your trials begins now.
The young assistant released the prey's arm. The older one slapped the prisoner on the back and yelled,
Run!
The man stumbled down the ramp, but somehow caught himself from falling. He glanced back, his face dark with fear, before racing toward the woods. When the prey reached the trees and 2 additional minutes had almost passed, Mr. Lean said,
Prepare yourselves. 5 seconds. 4, 3, 2, 1. Hunt.
Something hard pressed against Ricky's cheek, but that was nothing compared to the headache raging in his head. It took a Herculean effort to pry his eyelids open a fraction of an inch, but the effort was wasted as his surroundings were as dark as they had been when his eyes were closed. He tried to recall what had happened. The transparent cages, the woman yelling at him to get her out, the sound of gas filling the room, Rosario coughing, and him coughing too.
Oh, crap.
He shoved himself up, the sudden rush of adrenaline keeping most of his pain at bay. He ran a hand over his body to make sure nothing was broken. Thankfully, other than the sore cheek and the headache, he seemed to be okay. He slowly rose to his feet and reached for the pocket where he usually kept his phone.
Right, he muttered, remembering.
He'd destroyed his phone. It had been the right thing to do, but it sure would have been nice to have use of its flashlight. He extended an arm, intending to shuffle forward until he found a wall, but he hit a flat surface without having to take a step.
Good, this is good. Just need to follow it to a door and I'm in business.
He moved down the wall, keeping a hand on it, but went only a few steps before he reached a corner. He turned down the next wall. Two steps, another corner. Dread rose in his chest as he headed along the third wall. When he quickly reached yet another corner, he raised a hand above his head. 2 feet up, it hit a ceiling. He hadn't woken on the floor of the room where he'd collapsed. He was in one of those crazy plexiglass cells. His first instinct was to hit the walls and scream at the top of his lungs, like the woman he and Rosario had found. But he knew, from being on the other side, it would only get him a whole lot of nothing. He began a tactile examination of the cell, paying special attention to the seam where the box met the platform. As he feared, they fit tightly together. Without any tools, he had no way to lever the box out. He tried pushing up on the roof. Nothing. Thinking maybe he could dislodge the box by tipping the whole thing over, he threw his weight against the side over and over, but the enclosure remained rooted in place. He stood in the center, his shoulders sore from beating it against the wall, and tried to come up with another method. Before another idea came to him, the overhead lights flickered on. He blinked, and for a few seconds could see nothing but white. Then things started coming into focus. He wasn't in the room he'd blacked out in. There were only 3 other transparent cells here, and unlike the other space, this room had a wide stainless steel workbench running along 2 of the walls, plus several stainless steel tables scattered around. But the most disturbing things were the restraint-equipped dentist chair, there was no other way to describe it, in the center of the room, and the heavy-duty hoist hanging above it, attached to tracks that ran across the ceiling. He checked the other cells. They were all occupied, but like his, none had cots. Rosario was in the cell farthest from him, apparently still unconscious. In the containers between them were an African-American man and another woman, both also out. From across the room, the door opened. For a brief second, he considered dropping to the floor and feigning sleep, but he was pretty sure they already knew he was up. There had been a camera in the other room, so one was probably here too. He moved to the end of his cell and stared toward the entrance. The young guy who walked in was the same one Ricky and Rosario had seen helping Slater. Ricky watched him pull a full-length leather apron off a peg on the wall and put it on. Next, he donned a pair of heavy-duty rubber gloves that extended all the way to his elbows. If Ricky didn't know any better, he would have thought the kid was about to slaughter a cow. Though there were no cows in the room, Ricky worried he wasn't too far off about the slaughtering part. The kid spent some time at one of the workbenches, pulling things out of drawers and fiddling with them on the counter. He faced the other way, preventing Ricky from seeing what he was doing. After he finished, the kid carried a metal tray over to the table next to the dentist chair and reclined the chair as flat as it would go, swinging its arms to the side. He pulled a thin rectangular box from a pocket on the apron and tapped it. The hanging harness moved toward Rosario's cell. Another push on the remote brought the rig to a halt above her. Slater's man walked over, peered at Rosario, and reached under her platform. Ricky couldn't see what the guy was doing, but he knew it must involve the buttons beneath. When the kid straightened up, he studied Rosario again. From all appearances, whatever he'd pushed had done nothing, but Ricky didn't believe that for a second. He was willing to bet more invisible gas had just been released in her cell to make sure she stayed asleep. Slater's man stepped over to the other woman's box, checked inside, and flipped something under her platform. He repeated the process at the box of the man next to Ricky. He then walked up to Ricky's cell. The asshole locked eyes with Ricky and smirked. If the wall hadn't been between them, Ricky would have smacked the look right off the kid's face. Since that was currently not an option, he simply stared back, his expression blank. The game of don't blink went on for nearly a minute before the kid snorted and leaned down in front of Ricky's cell. Ricky guessed it was his turn to be put under, but instead of the whoosh of gas, he heard the echoing sounds of the room beyond the plexiglass. The kid stood up again.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you sure broke into the wrong place.
A whole list of smart-ass retorts played through Ricky's mind, not the least of which was,
do you always talk in cliches, or is this a recent problem?
But he held his tongue, his expression unchanged. The kid's smugness cracked a little at Ricky's non-reaction. With a tad more venom in his tone, the guy said,
if you think you're getting out of this, you're sorely mistaken.
Sorely? Who taught this guy to speak?
By this time tomorrow, it'll all be over. I hope you're ready to meet your maker, scum.
Video games. That has to be it. He watches too damn many video games. The kid reached under the platform and flicked off the speaker. Again, Ricky assumed he was about to be gassed, but his jailer walked away without the air in the cell changing. Ricky watched as the guy opened Rosario's cell and transferred her into the harness. A motor raised her into the air, and the rig transported her to the dentist chair. After she was strapped into the seat, the kid picked up a gun-like device from the tray and placed it against the base of her neck.
Son of a bitch, Ricky muttered.
Though the instrument was crude, he'd seen its type when one was used on him. The kid pulled the trigger, and the gun recoiled off Rosario's skin. He ran a finger over the contact point and smiled. When Ricky had been recruited to join the administrator's organization, one of the conditions had been that he agreed to be implanted with tracking bugs so that the administrator would always be able to find him. 5 bugs, in fact, a few inserted in places Ricky couldn't reach on his own. The device that had implanted those bugs was a more advanced version of the one the kid had used. Why the prisoners would need tracking bugs, Ricky didn't know, but he didn't like it, not one bit. Over the next 20 minutes, the guy performed the same task on the 2 other captives. Then he approached Ricky's cell. He pointed at Ricky, then at his wrist, like he was wearing a watch. Your turn, he was saying. He laughed and reached under the platform again. This time, the whoosh of gas was unmistakable. 26. Ananka checked her phone as she walked from the Mustang back to her hotel room. Still nothing from Ricky. She tried calling him. Voicemail again. She tried Rosario. Same thing. She sent them both a text, call me ASAP, and kept the cell in her hand as she walked. The device remained silent. She checked for active bugs again, but nothing new had appeared. When she reached her room, she opened her laptop and started a video chat with Shinji. Can you get me a location on Ricky's and Rosario's phones?
What's wrong?
They should have checked in by now.
Give me a second.
She stared at the computer while he worked.
That's weird, he said several moments later.
What?
Their phones are gone.
What do you mean gone?
Neither registers on the network.
Try the satellite link. The phones could use either cell or sat-tech.
I did. Not there either.
He tapped his keyboard.
The last cell tower they connected to is the one covering Green Hills Estates.
None after that?
No. The signal cut off while within its coverage 47 minutes ago.
The worried look on his face mirrored what Ananka felt. Keeping Shinji on the computer, she called Liesl. We have a problem. She told Liesl about their friends being MIA. Meet me in the parking lot next to the cash bar, then we'll go together from there.
En avant,
Liesl said. Ananka looked back at Shinji. Anything new on Rally that could help us?
Haven't figured out who he really is yet, but he wasn't born Devon Rally.
Her brow furrowed. Are you sure?
Oh, he's created a pretty elaborate cover, but it's still a cover, no doubt in my mind.
Contact me the moment you have anything new.
Will do.
As she headed out of her room, she knew there was one thing she needed to do before she rendezvoused with her friends. She had intended on ignoring the problem, but with Rosario and Ricky missing, it seemed a good idea to turn it to her advantage. Morgan lowered her binoculars just far enough for her to see the Collins Inn over the top of them. She was starting to think she was spinning her wheels by following Sean, and that she was deluding herself in thinking the woman would lead her to Tasha. But she couldn't go back home and sit around waiting again either. She would go crazy. What then? Approaching Scudder could still screw things up for Sean, so it was best to keep that off the table for now. What about Scott Davos? He certainly wouldn't be easy to get to,
But she'd already contacted him once, so he knew who she was, and if he really was worried about Tasha, Morgan was sure he would talk to her. At the very least, Davos could confirm whether Sean was on the level or not. She raised the binoculars again. The hotel was still quiet, the Mustang right where it had been the last time she looked.
I'll give her 30 minutes.
If Sean didn't show up by then, Morgan would work the Davos angle, and if she struck out with him, she'd... Something thumped against the passenger door. Morgan snapped her head around while reaching for her service weapon, which was tucked between the seat and the console. Sean waved from the other side of the window. Are you going to unlock this or what? Morgan cursed under her breath, then triggered the electric lock. Sean hopped into the other seat and fastened the belt.
What are you doing? Morgan asked.
You have heard of global warming, right? I figured if you were going to keep following me, we should share a vehicle. Now come on, we're wasting time.
Hold on, I'm not-
Let's go, let's go. I've got two people in trouble and two waiting for us. Or would you rather I drive myself and keep pretending I don't know you're behind me?
Morgan started the engine. Where are we going?
Kashbar, fast.
Morgan headed back to the highway and turned north. Why are your friends in trouble?
That's a good question. I don't know.
What happened?
Same answer.
They rode in silence for half a minute. Did you learn anything from Scudder?
Morgan asked.
Sean looked at her and smirked.
Only that he's not involved.
Are you sure?
100%? No, but close enough.
More silence.
Not going to ask me about digital paste? Sean said.
I was thinking about it. Why did you go to digital paste?
Because I'm pretty sure Devon Rally is involved.
Rally? That prick?
I see you've had the pleasure.
We've received a complaint or two, but no charges filed.
Let me guess, Sean said. He's all smiles and hands.
Morgan nodded. And unfortunately has the cash to make his problems go away. What makes you think he's involved?
You'll find out soon enough.
A few minutes later, they turned into the cash bar's parking lot. Over there, far end of the lot.
Sean pointed at a sedan sitting by itself.
Morgan recognized it as the one she'd seen Sean's associates use when Sean was at TJ's grill with Scudder. Morgan parked next to it, and she and Sean took seats in the back of the sedan. The Irish guy was behind the wheel and the Asian woman in the passenger seat. They both glanced at Morgan suspiciously before looking at Sean.
Under the circumstances, I thought we could use some extra help.
Not a bad choice, the Irish guy said.
So, any word from...
He glanced at Morgan again, not sure if he should continue. Sean frowned, said,
Right, and turned to Morgan. Okay, here's the deal. My name's not Sean Ramey, it's Ananka. My friends here are Dylan and Liesl. The two who are missing are Rosario, who you know as Caroline, and Ricky. He's the one who helped Dylan split open your head. Which, if I may remind everyone, wasn't on purpose, Dylan threw in.
Ananka said to him,
The answer is no, I still haven't heard from them.
Morgan was not surprised the Sean Ramey name had been a cover. She wouldn't be shocked if the new names were false, too. Ananka turned to her again.
Are you familiar with Dalton Slater?
Morgan's face tightened. I went to school with his daughter.
You don't sound too happy about it.
Let's just say they're not a very tolerant family.
Did you know that he's your chief of police's stepson?
What?
She had not known that. And half-brother to your chief's other son, Leonard Yates?
Is that really true?
We haven't performed a DNA test, but yeah, it's true. Last night there was a delivery at Scholarian that we think involved the involuntary transportation of people.
Harris's brow furrowed. You mean trafficking?
Ananka nodded. Present were both Slater and Leonard Yates. Today I sent Rosario and Ricky to plant a tracking bug on Slater's truck. They followed it to Devon Rally's house in Green Hills Estates, and that's where their phones went dead.
You think they're still at the house? Harris said.
I don't actually know if they got all the way there, Ananka said. I only know they were nearby earlier this afternoon.
That's what we're going to go check right now. The thing is, I'd rather not use the main entrance to the estates, so please tell me you know another way in.
Morgan did indeed know another way. Back when she was a teenager, in the days before the valley became Green Hills Estates, she and her friends had explored pretty much every square inch of the county. In small and dying Bradbury, there had been little else to do. In the hills between the highway and the valley, where the estates were now,
was a hidden place high school kids had been using as a party hangout for years. Morgan directed Dylan through wide gulches and barely visible roads into the hills.
"Are you sure this is the right way?"
Dylan asked, not for the first time.
"Did you grow up around here?" Morgan said. "No, you didn't."
A few minutes later, she pointed ahead.
"See that tree up there on the right? The one that's half dead?"
"I see it," Dylan said.
"The turn's just after it. It'll be a little steep at first, so you'll need some speed to get over the hump, but trust me."
As they neared the target tree, Dylan pressed down on the accelerator. As soon as they passed the marker and he saw the road, he whipped the car to the left and raced up a short slope. After cresting, the sedan thudded down, right in line with a pair of tire ruts carved through a grassy meadow. They crossed the clearing, re-entered the woods, and soon were headed upward again. This time, the pseudo-road looped back and forth so that the climb was not so difficult. Not long after it finally leveled off, the road ended in a clearing with no other visible exits.
"Where next?" Dylan asked.
"Stop. We walk from here."
They piled out of the car, and Morgan started toward the trail that would take them down into the valley.
"Wait a minute," Ananka called.
Morgan glanced over her shoulder and saw the others gathered at the open trunk of the sedan. She jogged back to them. In the storage space were two black suitcases sitting side by side. One was open, revealing a rack of pistols, a section of ammo magazines, several cylindrical devices, a few rifles with folding stocks, and at least half a dozen boxes of ammunition. Ananka handed weapons out to her friends, took a pistol for herself, then grabbed a cylinder and attached it to the end of the barrel. A suppressor, Morgan realized. Ananka glanced at her.
"You're not getting one."
"It's okay. I brought my own."
She opened the side of the zip-up hoodie she was wearing and flashed her service weapon.
"Yeah, you're leaving that here."
"What?"
"This is our operation. If there's any shooting going on, we'll be doing it. And if that's not enough reason for you, remember, you live here. You need to keep your hands as clean as possible."
"I'll be fine."
"I'm sure you will be. Now, give me the gun."
Though Morgan didn't like it, she handed over her weapon. Ananka put it in the case with the unused weapons, closed the top, and opened the second suitcase. Inside were several containers and a row of compact binoculars. She handed out the glasses, giving Morgan a pair too.
"If it comes to it, you can whack someone on the head with this."
"Gee, thanks," Morgan said.
Items she didn't recognize were removed from some of the containers and divvied up between the three others. Lastly, Ananka pulled out four palm-sized leather pouches and tossed one to each of them, once more including Morgan.
"Put it on," Ananka said.
"What is it?"
"Radio. The disc is a microphone. Take off the protective backing and stick it on the inside of your collar. I'm sure you can figure out where to put the earpiece yourself."
Ananka shut the trunk, donned her radio, and looked around.
"Everyone set?"
"Set, boss," Dylan said.
"Sit,"
Liesl said. Morgan nodded.
"Set."
"All right," Ananka said. "Lead on."
Ananka, Liesl, and Dylan followed Harris through the woods along a single-file trail that led over the summit and down into the valley. As they passed through a gap between trees, Harris pointed to the northeast.
"See that water? That's the pond near where the old Linden farmhouse used to be."
Ananka raised her binoculars.
"And the white building near it? That's the barn?"
Harris checked through her own glasses.
"Yeah, and to the right of it, and a little farther away, you can see part of Raleigh's house."
Ananka picked out the mansion and scanned Raleigh's property.
"Anyone see Ricky's motorcycle?"
For nearly half a minute, they silently examined the valley below.
"Found it," Liesl said.
"Where?"
"You see that rise about a quarter mile southwest of the pond?"
Ananka moved her binoculars. The top of the rise in question had been cleared and leveled, but currently was house-free.
"I see it."
"It is on the downslope that is facing us, near the right corner."
Ananka scanned the slope until she spotted it. It was definitely a motorcycle. Ricky's? Too far to know for sure.
"Dylan, swing over there and check it out. The rest of us will head for the woods north of the barn."
Dylan nodded and headed down the slope, on a line that would take him farther south. With Harris still leading, the women hiked down the hill toward the pond. When the slope became more gradual, they made better time, and soon were on flat land.
"Hold up," Ananka whispered.
Harris looked back, a question on her face.
"Fence,"
Ananka said, pointing past her. About 30 yards farther on, among the trees, a shadowy line traveled from left to right as far as she could see. Harris searched a bit before she saw it.
"There wasn't a fence there when I was a kid,
but that was a long time ago.
Stay behind me, Anaga said. Moving forward low and slow, she led them to a covered point 20 feet shy of the barrier where they crouched down.
While Liesl used the electronic signal detection app to check for cameras, Ananka scanned the fence through her binoculars.
The barrier was 5 feet high, made of large-gauge wire in a box-like pattern, strung between 4x4 wooden posts, and did not appear to be electrified.
No signals for at least 50 meters, Liesl said.
Ananka lowered her glasses.
You two stay here.
She crept up to the nearest fence post and examined it to make sure she hadn't missed a connector that would allow a portion of the wire to be charged. There was nothing. She waved the others over and clicked on her mic.
Dylan, you reached the bike yet?
Just a few seconds ago, he said.
It's Ricky's bike, all right. Any sign of him or Rosario?
No one here but me.
Footprints?
Checking.
He was silent for several seconds.
One set heading across the slope toward the rally house.
A short pause.
Two sets now. Second set smaller. They head down the slope.
The sound of sliding dirt and a whispered curse came over the line.
You all right?
Word of warning. These pine needles are pretty damn slippery. Rode on my arse all the way to the bottom.
Liesl snorted.
Yeah, hilarious, Dylan said. Okay, got the trail again. They're still heading toward Raleigh's house.
Follow them as far as you can, then meet us in the woods behind the barn. There's a fence around the property, but no sign of surveillance.
Copy.
Ananka, Liesl, and Harris climbed the fence and made their way through the forest until the barn came into view. Remaining in the safety of the trees, they scanned the area. There were no cars parked in back of the structure, or any doors or windows on the side of the building they could see.
You guys go right as far as you need and get a look around that side. I'll check the one to the left.
The east and west ends of the barn were shorter ends. Ananka found a spot where she could see the one to the east. No cars were parked along that side, but there was a door smack dab at the midpoint of the wall.
I've got an entrance over here, she said into her comm. What about you guys?
No, just a flat wall,
Liesl reported.
Come to where I am, then.
Ananka raised her binoculars. The door was shut and had no obvious locks. She made a sweep of the barn area to make sure she hadn't missed anything. Tire tracks creased the dirt about 20 feet away from the barn. They paralleled the building and looked recently made. The tracks also looked wider than those made by a standard car, like they were created by tires on an RV, or ones on large pickup trucks. Ricky had said he found the pickup on Raleigh's property, but hadn't said where. She'd assumed it had been parked at the house, but it could have been here at the barn. She focused on what she could see of the back of the mansion. No lights were on in any of the visible windows, nor did she detect any movement. But as she knew from the satellite image, the place was big. She couldn't be looking at more than a third of it, so the rest of the house could be filled with people.
Damn it, Ricky, where are you guys?
When Liesl and Harris reached her, she lowered the binoculars and said into the comm,
Dylan, ETA?
How about now?
All three of them turned to find Dylan emerging from the trees behind them.
Afternoon, ladies,
he whispered as he crouched next to Ananka.
So, what's the plan?
Ananka said, You and Morgan will stay here and watch the barn, while Liesl and I check the...
I hear a motor,
Liesl said. Ananka cocked her head and heard it too. It was hard to tell where it was coming from, other than the general direction beyond the mansion.
How far is the road that runs through the estates from here? She asked Harris.
Grand Way? It's gotta be at least a couple hundred yards beyond the house.
The rumble grew louder and louder.
Then it must be coming up the driveway, Ananka said.
Though they were well hidden already, Ananka and the others backed a few feet deeper into the woods as the roar increased. A cargo van came into view as it rounded the side of Raleigh's mansion. Ananka sensed Harris tense.
Do you recognize it?
I've seen a couple just like it in town before, Harris said.
Who do they belong to?
I've never had to stop one, so I don't know.
No logos or company name on them?
Not the ones I saw.
As the van continued toward them, Ananka's phone vibrated with a call. She reached into her pocket and pushed the button that sent the call to voicemail. She trained her binoculars on the van.
Two men in the cab. They look fairly young.
Harris, looking through her own glasses, said,
The driver's Justin Keller, and his friend is Aaron Sherwood. They graduated high school 2 or 3 years ago.
Trouble?
They spent more than their fair share of time at the station when they were still in school, but I don't think they've been back since they started working for Slater.
Ananka's phone vibrated twice with a text, but she kept her eyes on the van as it pulled up next to the barn, parking in the same area where she'd seen the tire tracks. Keller and Sherwood hopped out.
While Keller headed to the barn door, Sherwood disappeared around the back of the vehicle. Anaka kept her eyes on Keller. He touched the wall near the door, released a hinged panel, and tapped something within the recess several times. He then shut the panel and pulled the barn door open. Clearly, the building was more than it pretended to be.
"They are not alone," Liesl whispered.
Anaka looked back at the van. Sherwood had stepped out from around the back end, accompanied by two more young males. Harris grunted.
"Caleb Fredericks and Oral Johnson, two more of Slater's screw-ups. They both graduated last year."
"Which one's which?"
"Johnson's the taller one."
"Is it just me, or do they look like they could all be brothers?"
Dylan said.
It was true. All four were Caucasian, within an inch or two on either side of 6 feet, and had similar brown hair, cut military style. They were dressed identically, too, in jeans and gray t-shirts. The group talked for a moment in front of the barn door, then three of them went inside, while Fredericks jogged over to the back of the van and moved out of sight again. When he reappeared seconds later, he carried an M4 rifle. He jogged back to the barn door and took up sentry duty.
"Liesl."
Anaka nodded toward the trees on the other side of the van.
"Work your way over there and see if you can get a view into the back of the van."
Liesl nodded and vanished into the woods. Anaka kept her attention on Fredericks, knowing he would give them the first indication the others were returning. 2 minutes passed. Three. Then,
"In position."
Liesl's voice, soft over the comm.
"What do you see?"
Anaka asked.
"Racks on both sides of the van with two wide shelves each."
Anaka did not like the sound of that.
"Movement,"
Dylan whispered. Fredericks had turned to face inside the barn and appeared to be talking to someone. Though they couldn't hear what was being said, Anaka did pick up the faint rattle of wheels on wood. A few seconds later, Frederick stepped to the side and Keller exited, followed by a kid who hadn't been in the van but shared the group's compulsion to dress alike. He, too, was carrying an assault rifle.
"Vander Keen," Harris whispered.
Another one of Slater's rescues, Anaka assumed. Keller said something to Keen that directed him to the back of the van, where he took a guard stance, rifle ready. Fredericks assumed a similar position near the front of the van, facing the direction of Anaka and her team. Keller disappeared inside the barn momentarily, and then walked back out in reverse, pulling one end of a metal cart. Stretched on top was the unconscious body of a man. The other end of the cart was being pushed by Sherwood. Anaka focused the binoculars on the prone man, an African-American, around 40, clothes smudged with dirt. His chest moved up and down, so at least he wasn't dead.
"Do you know the guy on the cart?"
she asked Harris. Harris shook her head, frowning, and lowered her glasses.
"You weren't lying about the trafficking thing, were you?"
"We weren't lying about anything. Except our names," Dylan said. "Oh, and why we were here." And Anaka glared at him.
"What?"
She focused back on the van, and the two men wheeling the cart to the rear. When they moved out of view, she said,
"Liesl, what do you see?"
"The person on the table is being moved into the van. Now they are putting him on one of the shelves."
When the transfer was complete, Sherwood pushed the cart back into the barn, with Keller following. After a short pause, a second cart rolled out with Keller once again in front, only this time with Johnson pushing.
Anaka, are you seeing what I'm seeing?"
Dylan asked. Ananka's grip on her binoculars had tightened. She was indeed seeing what Dylan was seeing.
"What is it?"
Harris asked.
"That's Ricky," Anaka whispered through clenched teeth.
The men rolled Ricky behind the van.
"They are loading him in," Liesl said. "Top spot on the right."
When cart number 3 came out, pushed by Sherwood, Anaka knew exactly who would be on it.
"Say the word and we can take them down right now,"
Dylan said when he realized the unconscious passenger was Rosario.
"They're a bunch of kids. They don't stand a chance."
He was right. Two quick shots would take down the sentries, and the team could neutralize the two men at the cart before the assholes realized what had happened. They might have to work a little to get Johnson, who'd headed back into the barn, but it would be easy enough. If Anaka and the others mounted a rescue right now, however, they would likely damage the chances of taking down everyone involved and uncovering the full scope of the operation.
"I wish we could," Anaka whispered, "but we need to find out where they're going first. I want you to go back to Ricky's bike and follow them on it. We'll catch up to you as soon as we can."
She could tell Dylan was a bit disappointed, but he nodded and headed into the woods.
"They are putting Rosario on the shelf below Ricky,"
Liesl reported. The men returned to the barn, and Keller and Johnson rolled out a fourth cart. Ananka was watching through her binoculars, so she didn't notice Harris move until she heard the crunch of leaves under the woman's foot. Ananka grabbed Harris by the waist and yanked her down behind a bush.
Where the hell do you think you're going?
Let me go! That's Tasha!
Harris tried to break free, but Ananka had more than enough strength to hold her where she was.
Stop! It's not her!
Your friends are there! It has to be her!
Use your binoculars!
Harris lifted her binoculars. When she lowered them again, she looked crestfallen. You wanted it to be her. Our friends were there, so why not Tasha, too?
Maybe she's in the barn.
Or maybe she's wherever the van's going. She could be anywhere.
She's alive. I know she is.
I believe you, Ananka said, meaning she believed Harris believed that. Harris took a few deep breaths.
You can let me go now.
You promise to stay with me?
A beat. I promise.
Ananka let her go. As Harris tried to right herself, her hand slipped on some needles and she fell forward into the brush.
Freeze, Ananka whispered.
Frederick's gaze had whipped in their direction at the sound of branches rustling. He stared into the woods for a moment and took a few tentative steps toward them. Having finished returning the fourth cart to the barn, Keller, Johnson, and Sherwood came outside again, this time not pushing any cargo. When Keller realized Frederick's had moved from his position, he walked toward him.
Problem?
The driver asked, his voice raised just enough to carry into the woods.
I heard something.
A person?
Not sure, something moving around in the bushes.
Keller stared into the woods.
I don't see anything, do you?
Frederick frowned.
No.
Has there been any more noise?
Nothing after that first time.
Both men were silent for a few moments.
Probably a bird or something,
Keller said.
Come on, we need to keep to the schedule.
Keller turned and walked back to the van. After a moment's hesitation, Fredericks did the same. All four men who'd arrived in the vehicle climbed back inside it, while Keene re-entered the barn and closed the door.
Dylan, tell me you're ready, Ananka said into her comm. I have a little problem getting...
The roar of an engine erupted over the comm.
Yep, all set. Get out to the highway, they're leaving now.
Copy. Across the way, the van made a wide turn and drove toward the house.
I'm sorry, Harris said.
You slipped. It happens. Just let it be the only time.
It will be.
Once the van disappeared behind Raleigh's mansion, Ananka said, Everyone back to the car.
27.
Dylan didn't waste time finding a way through the hills back to the highway. Instead, he took Grand Way to the main exit and sped past the guard shack before the guy inside had a chance to look out the window. At the highway, he found a spot just to the south where he could see the start of the entrance road to the estates, but was hidden enough that the guys in the van wouldn't notice him when they drove out. Not much more than a minute later, the van stopped at the intersection with the highway. Instead of turning south, as Dylan had anticipated, it went north. Dylan eased back onto the highway and settled in a comfortable distance behind the van. He activated his mic and shouted over the noise of the road,
Ananka, come in!
When he received no response, he tried again.
Go for Ananka!
Her voice swam in a river of static as it challenged the range of the comm.
On the highway, in pursuit of the van, northbound!
Dylan, repeat!
In pursuit of the van, northbound on the highway!
Northbound!
North! He yelled, go north!
Dead air.
Ananka!
No answer.
Ananka?
He'd have to use his phone once he had the opportunity to stop. Until then, his mission was clear. Don't lose the van. Onward they went, paralleling the river, along the same path Ricky had brought Dylan the previous night when they visited the solar farm. It wasn't too long, in fact, before they neared that very turnoff. Dylan thought there was a good chance the van's destination lay somewhere in the farm's direction, but the other vehicle blew right past the road and continued northward. The setting sun had begun to cool the air that rushed over Dylan's gloveless hands, but his knuckles weren't the only things that ached. His arms and chest felt the chill, too. While Ricky's helmet had been with the bike, his leather jacket and riding gloves had not. Dylan wasn't dressed for a long motorcycle ride through the country, so he did the only thing he could. Grit his teeth and try not to think about it. 20 minutes beyond the solar farm turnoff, in the middle of what looked like nowhere, the van slowed. Its brake lights glowed in the twilight. Dylan, a few hundred yards back, contemplated slowing, too, but that might make the guys in the van suspicious. So he continued at his current speed and eased into the other lane as he neared them. Though he really wanted to glance over, he kept his face forward as he passed, like he had no interest in them at all. For a few moments, the van's headlights lit the road as Dylan headed away from them. Then they disappeared. He glanced over his shoulder. The van was no longer there.